Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. So happy to be here on this Friday afternoon with Jimmy Akin. And we're doing weird questions with Jimmy Akin. And I have to tell you, even in just casual conversation with Jimmy at the breaks, I learned new words. I got a brand new word from you, Jimmy. You don't even know.
Extratempestrial?
Oh, yes. You know, I've never heard that word before. And I was like, well, there we go. It's a self-explanatory word, but a really good one. Extratempestrials.
Mm-hmm. Refers to creatures from another time.
Yeah, yeah. But I had, at least that I can recall, I've never heard that before. Mm-hmm. Weird questions. We get a lot of them. Jimmy loves the weird questions. You can check out his work at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where he applies both faith and reason to all kinds of mysteries. And that's kind of what you do here. Jimmy, I've told you this before, but a lot of times we have other people, other apologists on or guests on the show, and they see a question that they have no idea how to answer. And because it's got some weird aspect to it, and they'll go, that's a Jimmy Akin question. So you actually these questions are actually called Jimmy Akin questions by lots of people. All right, let's get started again. This one comes from Kevin Kindright. Mr. Akin, I had my future told to me after I had a staring contest with a guy who had the ability to view my future life like watching a video in fast forward, pausing when he saw things he thought important. This is how he explained it to me. He was able to see all the way to my last day, something he said he hadn't been able to do with others. Not only could he see my life through my eyes, but he could also see what was going on all around me. I met him at work. Mr. Akin, have you ever heard of this type of ability before? Can you help me understand what happened and why, please?
Okay, so first I'll analyze the experience in terms of what was reported to you, and then I'll have a few comments on whether likely anything paranormal was happening here. In terms of the experience itself, so this gentleman said that he was able to see your life through your eyes in chronological order in stages. Now, so this would be a form of extrasensory perception or ESP, because he's not using his physical senses to get this information. So it would be classified as extrasensory, meaning from outside the physical senses. And so it would be a form of ESP. The effect of seeing the future, now there are three classical manifestations of ESP that are reported. They are clairvoyance, which is the ability to see distant or hidden locations in real time. Precognition, which is the ability to get information about the future, although it also has an opposite known as retrocognition, where you get information about the past. And then telepathy, which is mind-to-mind contact. So basically, in clairvoyance, you get information about another place. In precognition, you get information about another time. And then in telepathy, you get information from another mind. So you can think of them as mind to place, mind to time, and mind to mind. Okay. Well, so this would fundamentally be a, and then I should also add, in some cases, it's hard to pull apart those three and tell exactly which ability is being used. And so parapsychologists also sometimes refer to just general ESP or GESP. So in this case, he's reporting getting information about your future. So that would be precognition. He also says that he's seeing your life through your eyes. And that, to me at least, sounds like telepathy. So this could be a form of ESP, if it's real, that involves both precognition and telepathy. There's also another unusual feature about this, which is he sees your life progressively in an ordered sequence. one bit after another, going further and further into the future. That sounds like a phenomenon that is sometimes proposed for clairvoyance. Now, there are various people who report having what are called out-of-body experiences, where their perspective seems to shift away from their body and they can travel to further and further locations. And there is a question in with out-of-body experiences about whether anything actually leaves your body. And out-of-body experiencers are divided about this. Some of them think, yeah, there is something that leaves your body, but others say, no, this is just clairvoyance. And instead of leaping directly to some distant location and getting information about it clairvoyantly, instead, you get there in stages. So this is called traveling clairvoyance, because your perspective travels to the distant location. And so if any of this is real, and if traveling clairvoyance is real, then this sounds like a form of traveling precognition, where he sees your near future first, and then he travels into your further future, and then eventually he sees your dying day. So that's the general kind of sketch of how the categories of parapsychology would apply to this. It sounds like traveling precognition coupled with possibly with telepathy. Okay. Now, what would I say about whether this involved anything paranormal? Well, anytime something paranormal happens, you need to make a list of things that could explain it, both natural and paranormal, and then look at the contents of the list and see, do the natural explanations work? If some of the natural explanations work, you don't need to go any further. You've got a natural explanation, and you want to prefer the natural explanations, because normal natural phenomena are more common than paranormal phenomena. So two things occur to me about this. Fundamentally, there are natural explanations for this. The guy could just be imagining this. He could be committing fraud. He could be yanking your chain, you know. So I see multiple possible natural explanations. He could be mentally ill. So I would need to see some kind of evidence that would convince me that none of those natural explanations are real. And since this is a precognitive experience, well, okay, has anything he said come true in a way that exceeded random chance? And, you know, the answer might be yes, it might be no. There is evidence that if precognition is real, that we're not sensing necessarily the exact future, but a probable future, and so we can take steps to avoid it. If something undesirable is predicted, like if you see yourself dying in a car crash tomorrow on your way to work, you might take a different route to work so you don't get in the car crash. In fact, there have been studies of like train wrecks where they've noted that on the days where the train wrecks happen, the trains are unusually sparsely filled. It's like the people sensed they were going to be in a train wreck, so they took a different train.
Oh, weird.
But you still need evidence, and so that's called a predestination paradox. You still need evidence of something beyond random chance. So I would say, did he give you information about your future that has already been fulfilled in a way that exceeds random chance? If he didn't, then I would say I would be disinclined to believe this theory. Another reason I would be disinclined to believe this theory is it's atypical. This is not how precognition normally manifests. Normally, when people report precognitive experiences, it is not in this way. In the first place, 60% of the time that people have precognitive experiences, it tends to occur in the form of a realistic dream. But he was not dreaming. On the other hand, there's still 40% of the time when it doesn't happen in a realistic dream. And so So maybe his ability is part of that 40%, but it's still something I've never heard of it happening like this. Normally, even in that 40%, if people, I mean, they may have a symbolic dream or they may just have a flash of something, this is going to happen in the future. But they don't have this traveling clairvoyance. Traveling precognition when they're looking at someone. That's, to my knowledge, that hadn't been reported in the literature. It may have been, and I just haven't seen it. But as of right now, it sounds like this is an atypical experience. And generally, when people report atypical experiences, it has a natural explanation. This is also a rule that's applied in ghost investigations and things like that. If you get a client and the client reports something that sounds like it's out of a horror movie rather than what really gets reported normally in ghostly encounters, which is not horror movie-like, you're immediately suspicious. This person may be committing fraud because they want attention or book deal or movie deal. If it deviates too substantially from what other people have reported, that's reason to be suspicious. And this seems to deviate substantially from what other people who have precognitive experiences report.
Well, thank you very much for the question, Kevin. That was a great one to get us started. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and we'll continue with it right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Thanks for being here with us. Lots of weird questions lined up, and this one comes from Bethany 45101. What if the priest doing Mass is really old and suddenly dies during the service? How is that handled?
Well, there's a document called De Defectibus, which is Latin for on defects, meaning on defects occurring in the celebration of Mass, that was part of the 1962 Missal that actually goes into this very subject, among other defects that can happen. But having the priest drop dead during Mass is definitely a defect in the Mass. And the basic distinction is between whether he dies before or after the consecration has happened, or in the middle of the consecration. If he dies before the consecration has happened, then you can basically discontinue the Mass. It doesn't have to be completed. And so, you know, the whoever's in charge can say, I'm sorry, but we'll celebrate Mass at a later time, you know, because Father so-and-so has just passed on. If he dies after both consecrations have happened, then you could have other people, like extraordinary ministers, complete the distribution of communion. They couldn't say the prayers the priest is assigned, but they could at least distribute communion to those who were there. The most significant case is, what if he dies after the consecration of the bread but before the consecration of the wine? In this case, you've got one element consecrated and the other not. And canon law provides that the two elements are never to be consecrated independently, and it uses the strongest possible language in Latin, nephos. That means never, ever, 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 under any circumstances, do this. So if the bread has been consecrated and the wine has, and then the priest dies before the consecration of the wine, then you have to suspend the Mass until you can bring in another priest to complete the consecration of the wine and finish the Mass. People may need to be left there to guard the, you know, the consecrated hosts, you know, to protect them from profanation and so forth until a new priest can be brought in. But you got to get a new priest to come in and finish the liturgy. So that's a basic sketch of how it can be handled. If you want more of the details, I would suggest checking out a copy of De Defectibus. There are English translations of it online.
Bethany, thank you for that question. Bet you didn't know there was quite so precise an answer, did you, Bethany? This one comes from Dennis G. 33. Which church, sui juris, would, would extraterrestrials join if they accepted the faith?
Anyone they want. You can join any. So a church sui juris is Latin for with its own law. And frequently in English, these churches are referred to, many of them are referred to as Eastern rites. That's not really the correct term for them. But the Latin rite and all of the Eastern rites are churches with their own laws. So they're all church sui jurises. To use a really weird anglicization of the plural of a Latin phrase. But you can join if you're not a baptized Catholic, you can join any church sui juris you want. And so if aliens came down and wanted to join one, they could join the Latin rite, they could join the Maronite rite, they could join the Chaldean rite, they could join any church sui juris that they chose to.
All right. Hope that that was helpful to you. Dennis G33. Let's go to JP Morgan's 1095. Has Protestant exorcism ever been validated? Is Protestant exorcism only the goofy stuff like Bob Larson and Benny Hinn yelling and throwing invisible spiritual inner chi fireballs at their subjects? Or does it have any credulity? Like the most severe case I've seen with the Warren family helping Maurice Frenchy tear up on camera footage?
Okay, so there are cluster questions here. If by the Warren family, I'm not familiar with the Frenchy Terrault case, but if by the Warren family you mean Ed and Lorraine Warren, they were Catholic. They were Catholic lay people, so they weren't authorized to perform exorcisms. They could perform deliverance prayers, though. But in terms of Protestant exorcism, has it been validated? Well, if you mean has there been a study performed, you know, looking at the effectiveness of Protestant exorcisms, I'm not aware of any study that's been done scientifically. But I see no reason not to accept it as a valid concept. Whether it's as effective or not, it, you know, will vary. It's going to depend on what they do, because not all Protestant exorcists have the same practices. But in the New Testament, there were you didn't even have to be a Christian to do exorcisms. Evil spirits exist all over the world. They affect people in all different kinds of cultures, and all different kinds of cultures have rites of exorcism to deal with them. In the New Testament, we have Jewish exorcists. I mean, they're also mentioned in other Second Temple Jewish literature, like the Jewish historian Josephus. But Jesus talks about Jewish exorcists, and, you know, they meet Jewish exorcists in Acts, and Jesus does not challenge that they are doing exorcism. In fact, when he gets accused of using demonic power to do his exorcisms, he says, "Well, then who are your sons driving out demons by?" He's, in other words, I'm using the same power they are. And so he acknowledges that Jewish exorcists are driving out demons, and they're not even Christians. Well, if you don't even have to be a Christian to do an exorcism, then there's no reason Protestants can't do them. In terms of, is it all the way Bob Larson or Benny Hinn does it? No. There are much more formal exorcisms in other branches of Protestantism. For example, you know, I'm plugged into the exorcist community, and I have talked with both Eastern Orthodox exorcists, and I've talked with Anglican exorcists, and they use a more formal ritual procedure just like Catholics do. So it's not all Wild West freewheeling, throwing chi fireballs at people and yelling at them. Although I should note, Catholic exorcists also can yell. But you do have exorcism, you know, in Protestantism. It is not as common, especially outside of the Pentecostal charismatic movement, as it is in, say, Catholicism or Orthodoxy. But it is real, and it can be effective.
All right. Thank you very much. I got time for another one before we have to go. Thank you to J.P. Morgaines, and I hope that that's working out for you in whatever market you're in. Rattlehead GY9CT asks this. Could aliens exist on another world, provided that the interpretation of Genesis be that God filled the entire universe with life as opposed to just Earth?
Well, I don't. So aliens could exist on another world, but that wouldn't necessitate change in the interpretation of Genesis, because all Genesis tells us in the creation narratives is God created life here on the Earth. It doesn't mention other planets. And so if God created other children of his on other planets, he just didn't tell us about it in Genesis. So you can still read Genesis as talking about the creation of life on Earth, which is all it addresses. So those would be the two points I'd make. If God chose to create aliens elsewhere, he could do that, but it wouldn't necessitate any change in the interpretation of Genesis.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. On we go. I should say Rattlehead GY9CT again. I don't want to miss getting to say that twice. Mario Master 97 wants to know this. Did Jesus have a body before he was born as a man?
Well, not unless there's something that hadn't been revealed to us. Now, we know Jesus acquired a human body when he became incarnate and was born as a man. It's conceivable that we also know his divine nature does not natively have a body, because divinity is a spirit, and spirits do not have bodies. So he didn't have a body because of his divine nature. Therefore, any body he acquired had to be an acquired body, could be either acquired temporarily, or it could be acquired in a permanent way through incarnation. In terms of could there have been a temporary body, well, there are occasions in the Old Testament where the angel of the Lord shows up, apparently in physical form. Also in Joshua, the commander of the Lord's army shows up, also apparently in physical form. And so some have interpreted the angel of the Lord or the commander of the Lord's army as being the pre-incarnate Jesus. And if he showed up in physical form, well, presumably that would have been a temporary body, just like the temporary bodies that angels can assume when they take physical form. But the only one we know of that he had on a permanent basis was when he became incarnate as a man. Hypothetically, could there be other ones? Well, yeah, there actually could, because God is omnipotent, and if he can take a body once, he can become incarnate once, he can become incarnate multiple times. This is something that Aquinas talks about. And so hypothetically, Jesus could, and it doesn't even have to have a rational nature. He could take other bodies, although Aquinas doesn't think it would be fitting for him to do that, but it's possible. If he also incarnated elsewhere in the world before he became incarnate as Jesus of Nazareth, then he would have an additional body or additional bodies that we're simply not told about. However, because we're not told about them, we have no reason to believe in them. You know, just because it's a hypothetical possibility doesn't mean we've got any evidence for it. And in fact, I would say we don't have evidence for it. So I wouldn't encourage people to believe any of this stuff. But out of a recognition of God's power, I would encourage them to recognize that it is possible that he could have done this. We just have no evidence that he did do this.
All right. This next question I've been wanting to get to, frankly. And Jimmy will take your questions. He takes them all seriously. S. Burton, 1971, asks this. How does Odo not turn into a pile of goo when he uses a transporter?
So this is a question referring to the show Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which has a shapeshifter named Odo, whose native form is a bunch of goo. But he can mold that goo into other shapes and appear, for example, as if he's a humanoid. Well, a transporter takes you apart on the molecular level and does so really fast, but I don't see any reason why it would affect Odo, because he obviously has some way of holding his molecules in place to impersonate a human. Maybe it's a telekinetic or psychokinetic ability. Maybe it's some chemical ability. But he's got a way to freeze his molecules into a stable form. And while they're in that stable form, a transporter could disassemble them and reassemble them. So I don't see any reason why he would have to convert into goo any more than we humans convert into goo when we get taken apart by a transporter in the Star Trek universe.
Thanks, S. Burton. Excellent question. Lots more questions to come. Weird ones for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are. But the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino-Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Yes, that's different music. It's because that's the weird, well, it's not weird music, but that's the music for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And we've got a lot of them, loads and loads of weird questions come to us for Jimmy. Where else on Catholic Radio are you getting questions about Odo in a transporter? In any media. I just don't know where you're going to get that quality of question. So, here's another one. This person's name, internet name, is Ultimate Original God. If I want my child to have all sacraments of initiation at once, like in the East in the former Roman practice, how can I do that? I want to have my future children sacramentalized as soon as possible.
Well, so if you want all now the time in a, so obviously baptism, that's given to all children, regardless of which Catholic Church sui juris you're in. In the Latin rite, the age of confirmation varies. And so you could, for example, go down to Mexico and have your child confirmed before the age that is customary here in the United States, where it varies but tends to be older. But that wouldn't get your child Holy Communion. So what you would need to do in this circumstance, if you want to do this, is you would need to go to an Eastern Rite church where all three sacraments are given to infants. And you'd need to go there long enough that you don't become a member of that rite, unless you want to, but you go there long enough that you can be considered a subject of the pastor of that parish. This is a difference in canon law between Eastern and Western Catholics. Here in the West, jurisdiction tends to be territorial. So you're subject to the pastor of whatever parish you live in, whether you go there or not. And that can become relevant, for example, when you're getting married. If you've been going to another parish forever, you still got to go to your territorial pastor in order to get permission for whoever you want to do the ceremony. On the other hand, in Eastern canon law, jurisdiction tends to be more subject-based than territory-based. So if you go to an Eastern Orthodox church long enough to become a subject of the pastor of that parish, then he can perform all three of the sacraments for your children. And you need to talk to him about, you know, make sure he's willing to do that, find out how long you need to attend there and stuff like that. But that would be the way to do it. Could you then bring your child for communion below the regular age of communion to a Latin parish? Yes, you could. Because once you're initiated to communion, you have a right to communion, even if you aren't of the age that that is customary in the church sui juris that you're attending. So if you have an Eastern Rite baby that has been initiated into the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist, and that baby is brought to a Latin Rite church, they're supposed to give that baby communion. Now, Eastern Rite parents who want that to happen may need to talk to the authorities at the Latin parish to make sure they understand the situation. But in principle, that baby has a right to the Eucharist once he's been admitted to it. And the same thing would be true of any child that you had admitted to the Eucharist in this way. You know, they should give it to the child, but, you know, convincing them of that may involve some work. And, you know, people can be stubborn mules at times, so you might encounter some difficulties, but that's what the law would indicate.
Ultimate, thank you very much for the question. This one comes from Jason. Jason Pohlmeier. Most people get half their DNA from their mother and half from their father. I assume Jesus got at least half of his DNA from Mary, but what about the other half? Was he 100% Mary? Did God just invent 50%? Do you think God made him resemble St. Joseph?
Okay, so this question comes up periodically, and he was not 100% Mary. That we can say for certain, because Jesus is a man. And that means he had not just an X chromosome that he would have inherited from Mary, he also had a Y chromosome. And so even if God, like, took a couple of ova from Mary and fused them into one so that you had a conception, or, you know, took a set of genetic material from one ova and then copy and pasted it, that would produce a female birth that would have a double X pattern. And so the absolute minimum is God would have had to come up with a Y chromosome in addition to any DNA that came from Mary. I think it's more likely that he came up with half of the DNA, and that only half came from Mary and half came from God, including the Y chromosome. Do I think that that God made him resemble St. Joseph? Well, this is all speculation. You know, we don't know what St. Joseph looked like. So I have no way of assessing this, but I can tell you, if I were God, I would not do that, because the whole point of the virgin birth is to make the point this is God's son. There was no human father. And so it would obscure that truth, which is what the virgin birth is designed to communicate, if God made him look like his foster father, Joseph. Because if he made him look like his foster father, Joseph, that would just lead people to say, ah, they just got together before they were married, and he's mm-hmm. not really virgin born at all. So if I were God, I would not make him look like St. Joseph.
All right. Let's see. That was Jason. Thank you, Jason. Thank you very much for that question. Emerson Green asks this question. Could someone be a Catholic atheist?
Well, it depends on the senses in which you use the terms. I know of instances where the phrase Catholic atheist does get used. I was talking to a friend of mine once from Northern Ireland, and he talked about, you know, how the culture over there is heavily dependent on are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic? And so he recounted that there are occasions where, you know, someone will get asked, are you a Protestant or a Catholic? And the person will say, I'm an atheist, to which the person asking the question will roll their eyes and say, yes, but are you a Protestant atheist or a Catholic atheist? Because being Protestant or Catholic is not simply a matter of religious belief. It's a matter of culture and which culture you affiliate with. In the same way, you can have Jewish atheists. You know, they're part of Jewish culture. They may not personally believe in God, but they identify with Jewish culture. And so you can have Jewish atheists. Now, in another sense, if you have someone who is an atheist, it's very hard to see how that person would not commit apostasy. Apostasy is the total repudiation of the Christian faith. And even though you might believe some things about Jesus, if you reject the existence of God fundamentally and say, I'm an atheist, well, you might be culturally a Catholic, but you're not theologically a Catholic. And in fact, if you have essentially abandoned the theology of Christianity, that's very plausibly read as an act of apostasy, in which case you would just be a non-Christian at that point. Even though you may be culturally Catholic and maybe even have a few Catholic beliefs, but I don't think one could be a Catholic atheist in the theological sense, but it certainly happens in the cultural sense.
Emerson, thanks. That'll bring us right to the break. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour, and there's lots more to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father Ramil Fajardo. Dear friends, if we understand the power of radio, then we can understand that the gospel can be made very real, very convincing, powerful enough to send shockwaves throughout the whole country and indeed the whole world. Catholic radio is necessary in order that the gospel be sent throughout all the world, and most importantly, a convincing witness of Christ's presence here on earth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Weird. We got lots of weird questions. Gathered them up for Jimmy Akin. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers
Jimmy
Live.
Jimmy Akin gathered them up for Jimmy Akin.
No, you're part of we. I just included you under the we in that one. Well, now I forgot where I am.
Question 19.
All right. Trent R8906 asked this. essential question. Really, this is essential to any apologetics discourse. If we discovered the creature from the Black Lagoon, would it be permissible to eat it in Lent?
Yeah, specifically Fridays during Lent or Ash Wednesday, which are the days that abstinence from meat is required, meaning meat of land dwelling birds and fowls. Okay, so if we discovered the creature from the Black Lagoon, could we eat it? Well, the creature from the Black Lagoon, despite its humanoid body form, is presented in the three movies that have been made about it as a fish-like creature. You know, it's not a mammal. And I saw you had a reaction to my mention of three movies.
I didn't know that.
The first one is The Creature from the Black Lagoon. The second is Revenge of the Creature. And the third is The Creature Walks Among Us.
Ah.
So it's either a fish or a reptile or something like that. And therefore, it's a water dweller. It's not a mammal. And so, yeah, you're a bird. And so, yeah, you could eat it without violating the restriction of needing to avoid flesh meat on those days. A related question is, would it be moral to eat it as opposed to canonically permitted to eat it? And there we get into the question of its intelligence, because mm-hmm. I don't think it's moral to eat creatures unnecessarily. I'm not talking about, you know, when your plane crashes in the Andes and you're all starving. But under ordinary circumstances, I don't think it's moral to eat creatures above a certain intelligence level if you have no necessity to. So, like, I don't think you could hunt and kill a human and eat them just because you want to, the way you could hunt and kill and eat a deer, you know, which is perfectly fine morally. So what level of intelligence does the creature from the Black Lagoon have? Well, it's been a while since I've seen the movies, but I know that in the third movie, The Creature Walks Among Us, the creature is starting to mutate a little bit. He's losing some of his appurtenances, like his gills and stuff. And his skin becomes more mammalian. And so they actually dress him in human clothes. But that's why it's Walks Among Us, because mm-hmm. he's like blending into society now. He still doesn't have human intelligence, but it's clear he's got enough intelligence that he can tell when he's being framed for a murder. When he's being framed for a crime.
Oh.
And that suggests, now, if you framed a dog for a crime, the dog is not going to have any idea what you're doing. If you framed a cat for a crime, the cat is not going to have any idea what you're doing. If you frame a cow or a pig for a crime, they are not going to understand what you're doing. So the creature has a significant level of non-human intelligence to be able to understand this concept. You can tell by its actions that it understands what's going on.
Right.
So I would say the creature is above the threshold that I would personally consider it moral to eat. To give a point of comparison, I used to eat, going out for sushi, I used to eat taco, which is not what you'd think, because it's not Mexican, it's Japanese, it's octopus. And I would eat ika, which is squid. And I liked taco and I liked ika, but I don't eat them anymore because I've done research and octopuses, to use the surprisingly accurate plural in English, octopus and squid are freaky smart. They're not human smart, but they are freaky smart. And they're smart enough that I just find it distasteful,
to eat them,
metaphorically speaking, to taste them literally. So the creature is even smarter than they are. in terms of its understanding of human relationships. So I would not want to eat the creature. Uh-huh. Then there's the fact that it's one of a kind, as far as we know, and you don't want to be causing one of a kind creatures to go extinct. So I also wouldn't eat it for that reason.
Trent, thank you for the question. So what I'm taking from that, though, Jimmy, is if you're flying over the Andes with the creature from the Black Lagoon, you get in a plane crash.
All bets are off.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That part I just wanted to clarify before we moved on. This one comes from Aldegundis. If a ship of volunteers is collected to go to Mars, should the church insist on sending a bishop?
Well, Cy Kellett, maybe I should throw this question over to you. What do you say?
Well, I wrote a little novella about this, about a bishop from Mars, called Ad Limina. So thank you for asking me. And I don't think the church would be in any position to insist, but why not send a bishop to Mars if you can?
Okay. So that's your answer. Yeah. I'll provide mine. It's going to depend on how many Catholics are going to be on Mars, and it's going to depend on how difficult the trip is, how long it takes to get to Mars. If this were a once in a generation trip, if it took, 20 years to get to Mars or something, or 40 years to get to Mars, then that would, if you have Catholics who are going and they're going to need pastoral care, you need a bishop on site to do further ordinations. And you got a really long time before another ship is going to come, then it would increase the need to have a bishop on that first colony ship. On the other hand, that's not what we're talking about. They're looking at getting people to Mars in like 2 years or something. And so you could have a bishop either visit to do ordinations of new priests, or you could have the new priests ordained here and shipped over there. And then you could assign them to the diocese of some particular earthbound bishop, like, let's say, the Diocese of Orlando, Florida, or something. Okay, so I don't think that it would be necessary, given current travel conditions. I also would look at the history of what happened the last time we discovered and colonized a new world, because this has happened before. I mean, you and I, Cy, are living in the new world. Yeah. North America is in terms of the Middle Ages, we are on Mars.
Right, right.
And so that's why they called the old world the old world and the new world the new world, because it was a whole new world they had found. Okay, and they colonized it. And the way they did that was the initial ships they sent over, I don't know that they had priests. They may have, but it wasn't necessary. Once there was a stable Catholic population, and even before there was a stable Catholic population in the New World, they started sending over missionaries, and they also started sending over priests. And eventually, given the travel difficulties between the Old World and the New World, once the Catholic population of the New World started to get to a certain level, it made sense to start appointing bishops, who were initially imports from Europe. And then later, as the situation matured in the New World, they began to appoint native bishops, people who had been born in the New World. So I would say that we're likely to see a similar pattern unfold with respect to Mars. So I don't think the church should insist on sending a bishop initially if the ship is a given colony ship is full of Catholics. I would say, well, they should insist on sending a priest to care for their spiritual needs. But as long as travel conditions allow people to get to and from Mars relatively quickly, I don't think they need to send a bishop until such time as the population, the Catholic population of Mars increases to the point that it becomes more practical to have local bishops.
Alde, I hope that was helpful to you. I don't know where they're going to get the wine and the for the mass on Mars, but that's another problem for another day.
They'll have to grow grapes or import it.
Martian wine, notoriously bad. But again, what for another day? Bethany Rose, 2023.
Actually, I've thought about writing a science fiction story that involves wine from Mars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it would be about a Martian family that is rich, that has this big multi-generational kind of dynasty. But in the end, the family loses its money and fails. And the final scene is of two characters drinking the last bottle of wine from the House of Mars.
Oh, we're going to need some soil up there first.
They've got soil on Mars. It's pretty red.
Well, yeah. All right, here's Bethany Rose's question. I work with a non-Christian lady who used to be a Hindu and claims to believe in the Christian God. She was not a very nice person from what I saw, how she treated other people. One day she told me a story that when she went to a church to pray, because she was having a problem at that time, she saw blood on her palm. The light in the Catholic church was dim, so she looked at the palm intensely and didn't know what it was. After a few seconds, the blood disappeared. She got spooked and thought that was a spooky church, so she went to the Anglican church nearby. Before she told me the story, I was listening to the life of St. Padre Pio, who had stigmata. My question is, does stigmata happen to anybody?
Well, it's certainly reported. You know, there are various reports of stigmatists down through church history and even today. The question is, you know, what evidence do we have in particular cases that this is the result of a paranormal phenomenon? Because there are other explanations for it that can apply in individual cases. There have been, for example, cases of imagination, where people imagine having stigmata. And this is particularly possible in cases of invisible stigmata. So there are some stigmatists who really do manifest blood that can be seen by the senses. There are, you know, St. Francis was one of those, St. Padre Pio is one of those, but a lot of stigmatists will say they can perceive their stigmata, but other people can't. So this is like a mental phenomenon rather than a physical one. And I don't rule out the possibility of God doing that. You know, he can give people visions of other things. He can give them visions of stigmata. So I don't rule that out in principle as a paranormal phenomenon, but it also is open to the possibility of mental illness or, you know, imagination or fraud. Even with physical stigmata, there have been cases of fraud. I am aware of a case involving some nuns a few centuries ago, where one of the nuns was a stigmatist, and it was physical. She could show you her hands, and she was even examined, you know, and the examiners said, yeah, it looks like she's really got stigmata. But then some other examiners came in, and they scrubbed harder, and they found that her stigmata were painted on. So it was a fraud. But there are cases where this is reported. Sometimes it has a natural explanation, but in other cases, it genuinely seems to have a paranormal explanation. There also may be cases where the power of self-suggestion causes skin to burst in a way that even though there's no obvious cause, it's still a psychological cause, but it happens to someone, that their skin bursts in a way that the stigmata appear on them. So it does happen. In terms of the Hindu lady that you mentioned, I'm glad that she says she believes in the Christian God. Actually, people don't realize this, but about 90% of Hindus are monotheists. They may talk about multiple gods, but most of them on surveys either say there is really only one God, or there may be multiple manifestations of the one God, but they're monotheists. And they would, in many of them, include, yeah, okay, so the Christian God is God. He's the true one God. So I'm glad that she's open to that. In terms of her experience, you know, I couldn't say what caused it, whether it was psychological or paranormal, but I can't rule it out that something paranormal happened in this situation. So I would be open-minded, but not convinced either. It's an interesting experience, and with no ability to investigate it, I would say that's very interesting. And I don't know whether it's genuinely paranormal or not. It could go either way.
Bethany Rose, thank you so much. Thanks to everybody who got their weird questions to us. We'll do it again, I'm sure, before too long, because it's fun to do. And it comes with this really awesome music. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcasts, or on YouTube. And check out the new podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast, available, again, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. That'll do it for us. I'm Cy Kellett. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.